2004. We're back for another month. Hello to everybody out there listening or joining us in the IRC. We've got the whole panel back with us tonight. Three out of five are in California tonight. We'll start off with Doc. How are you doing tonight, Doc?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I'm trying to do noise isolation here. There's big trucks going up and down the street outside. So, you know, we're emulating an actually civilized place. So now it's remarkably gloomy here in Santa Barbara, which is a rare thing. Usually it's kind of perfect, but right now it's kind of gloomy.
Well, isn't that like a good thing because it's so rare? It's sort of like an interesting change.
Right. They throw it in there just to simulate reality. You know, so it isn't like paradise on a constant basis.
Simulated reality is always the best.
Yeah, yeah.
Douglas Adams was right about that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why he died here, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, he was pumping iron at a hotel when he got a heart attack and dropped dead. There was a woman I once knew from the UK who, when she met me and heard I was from Santa Barbara, she said, "You killed Doug Adams." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "He never would have gone to a gym in England." So she knew him apparently. But that's a minor piece of news from Santa Barbara.
Yeah, the curse of Santa Barbara. So, Arnie, how are you on the backside of the mountains tonight?
Oh, it's pretty cool. We had some rain this morning, but it's kind of a nice day. Full moon out last night.
Yeah, it was a really interesting evening for observing the heavens with my telescope. I really enjoy it, actually, when the moon is so particularly bright, because it really does increase the sharpness of the planets.
Huh?
It makes them easier to find, too.
Full moon's usually the bane to visual astronomy.
Yeah. Well, two recommendations around that. One is K-STARS, which is just a great program. The other is there's a site online called Heavens Above. It's heavens-above.com. And it gives you what all of the satellites are doing every single night. And if you give it your location, like if you put in Aurora, Illinois, it'll tell you exactly what's passing over. So the other night, we were sitting out in our new hot tub. By the way, it's a very, very California thing to do. It's a brand new hot tub. And I was watching something that was like really bright and moving. It looked to me like, even though my glasses were off, I thought it was the space station. And it turns out it was the space station. I checked with Heavens Above. It was flying right overhead. It was great. Nice and bright. You could actually almost make out shape to it. even though it's 100 miles away, it doesn't look like a bright dot. It actually seems to have some shape to it.
Mm-hmm.
But pretty neat.
Yeah, too fast to track with a telescope, though. I've tried.
Oh, yeah, I know, and it's moving too fast. Yeah, definitely moving too fast.
Yep. But, still a wonderful night. No, Arnie, the answer to your statement is if you've got a really good telescope, looking at a planet with the moon up isn't a problem.
I know. They it's just that the moon is so bright that normally you don't like bright light in the sky when
the moon,
visual ops, right?
Yeah. Well, the moons of Jupiter are pretty much visible no matter what the moon's doing.
Yeah, they're visible with an unaided eye.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, it depends on the unaided eye. I used to be able to see them. I can't anymore. But my 7-year-old kid can. We have a game where he actually looks at them, and I say, okay, how many can you see? He says, well, I see one to the west, two to the east, and then we'll get out the, heavens above or some other piece of software and look it up and see, oh, okay. You know, he was caught right or close or whatever. It's pretty interesting.
Yep. Absolutely. Also in California tonight is Russ Pavlicek, locked away in a hotel. And what town are you in right now?
I'm in San Jose. And I'll tell you.
Santa County.
If this is some sort of bad weather, you fellas should head back east. It's doing that here.
Well, I'll be in D.C. this next weekend, by the way. Myself.
Well, I may or may not be. That's the thing that we still have to determine.
Oh, really?
But we're out here and we're enjoying it.
Oh, great.
That's good. What are you going to be in D.C. for next week, Doc?
My daughter is who teaches at University of Maryland in Baltimore. Has a play. It's a production, a puppet thing, but it's a deep subject. The subject is war. It's been selected as the best of college theater and will be performed at the Kennedy Center.
Wow.
It's a real big deal, and so it's on Monday and Tuesday night. For listeners in the D.C. area, there's still tickets available. It's called Buried, as in the past participle of the verb to bury.
Actually, I'm going to be in the D.C. area next Tuesday.
Okay, well, it's Monday and Tuesday night, and we'll be there Monday night, and then we're flying back Tuesday. So we should be back in time for the show next Tuesday, I hope.
Now, my plan is to do a little noise making on Tuesday afternoon, and we'll talk about that during segment number 2 of the show tonight. But how are you doing tonight, Kevin?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. Been fighting off a cold that just been halfway hitting me for the last couple of weeks now.
All the servers running good?
Oh yeah. In fact, we have a new server up and running tonight.
Is that the Rhodey?
Yep.
Yep. I actually this is sort of a funny story. I spent late last week and all weekend long, and I mean when I say all weekend long, I mean all weekend long, down in our Chicago NOC. The reason why I was down there so much was that I had been told by our landlord that he had gotten a call on Thursday from OSHA, that OSHA was going to do a surprise inspection of the building on Monday. Yesterday, and so to make sure that we get everything in our facility organized, of course, it wasn't, things have been stacked up and, put aside for later, and so while I was spending Friday, Saturday, and then Sunday in an intensive reorganization of our NOC because we had been rebuilding so much stuff, it was just a terrible mess. We got a whole bunch more equipment online while I was down there, things that we didn't anticipate even starting up for a month or two. So we got a lot of equipment running now. Now all we have to do is find bandwidth for it, and we'll be in really good shape. But the irony of all this is this turned out to be a fraud. The guy who called up and said he was from OSHA was actually from a company that they sold a service of going into companies' offices and pre-inspecting for them so that they could pass the OSHA inspection. Okay, well, it was, you know, the knack was a mess. I should have cleaned it up a long time ago, so it was sort of a good thing it got a fire under my butt. But there were people in that building that over the course of that weekend, they probably spent, $3,000-$4,000 easily in excess overtime, having their employees, you know, just go from one end of their company to the other, making sure that everything was okay. Not that that's, you know, it sounds silly, because that's not a bad thing. It's just that they might not have done it on, you know, double time or triple time, having their employees come in on a Sunday. And so needless to say, this guy got pretty roughed up, but some of the tenants in the building, he almost got the crap beat out of him. And the police were called because he was upset because people were roughing him up. Police were called, and the police officers, when they found out what was going on, they said, "You're lucky you're alive. This is Chicago." So, but anyways, we got tons of equipment online. I mean, really, lots of excess equipment. So, in the very near future, when we can match up some bandwidth to all this equipment, there'll be plenty of streams for people. Well, let's go ahead and jump into segment number one. We're going to go over to Russ first because Russ is on a limited time schedule tonight, and he's going to have to take off in about 15 or 20 minutes. So, Russ, let's jump over to you first and talk about your stories.
All righty. Well, I have three on the list out there on the Linux Show website. Unfortunately, I'm working a little blind here, folks, so forgive me if I can't go into quite as much detail. But it's kind of interesting. The three stories together, you could put it under the subheading of "The Plot Thickens." These represent, you know, not the latest round for conspiracy theories, but I believe that they are three chess moves basically being laid as we watch by various people around the Linux industry. The first one is a report from a Yankee group that proclaims that Linux is not a low-cost alternative to Unix and Windows. Now,
no cost is.
This is one of those interesting pieces that you know is going to land on many bosses' desks over the next month or two. Once again, it's positioning kind of dissimilar things. It's sampling, as I recall, it sampled pretty heavily from the top. It was the description that they gave, that they were asking the CIOs and so forth about the expense of going to a Linux solution. And they said, well, it's too expensive to go there now, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, if you consider the amount of money that transition for no good reason takes, then yeah, you know, it's not like plugging Linux into your PC suddenly saves you gobs of money. There has to be a reason for it all, is what it comes down to. And this comes as no surprise to anyone in the business that it costs money to change. Big whoop-de-doo. But what we are finding, of course, those of us that are actually trying to live in the real world when it comes to this sort of thing, is that there are reasons why you have to change, be it some sort of upgrade of existing software, you're trying to get some more functionality, you're trying to add horsepower, whatever the hell it is. There is a need to change, and when that need to change comes, then you can start a little bit closer to an apples-to-apples comparison for pricing. So if this starts showing up on your boss's desk in the near future, it probably makes sense to read up on it a little bit so you can talk about it intelligently.
I have a couple comments about that article.
Go for it.
First of all, you're dead on about the fact that change is expensive. And what they're doing is asking these IT managers, high level managers, whether they want to, whether you know, about the cost of moving to Linux. Of course, if they're moving to Linux, that means they're not on Linux. And no one is going to be wanting to move to Linux from any operating system they're using unless, like you say, they have a reason. Also, that's going to be costly, and everybody knows that. I'm astounded at the number of links to this article. And, you know, I can, like you say, I can see it appearing, the report appearing on managers' desktops everywhere. But, you know, it doesn't say anything. This report says nothing important.
Nothing important, but it's going to be shouted from the housetops by certain parties who have a vested interest in having this repeated.
This is nothing important. This is not new information. Anybody who's looked at Linux knows exactly this, or anybody who knows anything about computers knows this is true.
The other thing that that got me about this, because I've been doing some a little bit of writing about this recently, is that once again it's a sampling from the top, and part of the reason why so many of the analyst groups have been so consistently wrong about the growth of Linux is because they're trying to do all of the sampling, opinion sampling, from the top rung of the ladder. What we have found, as with other disruptive technologies, is that there are a lot of things that come in from the bottom. And if you're not doing some sampling from the bottom, too, then you're never going to get a complete picture. And that's what we're seeing here, what comes down to an incomplete picture. The second part of this triumvirate here talks about Sun and Microsoft entering into a, quote, unholy alliance, unquote. Once again, another chess move. And it's one of those things that if you read some of the analysis that's going on right now, a lot of people are raising an eyebrow at Sun, because Sun, with one hand, seems to be embracing open source, and with another, seems to be trying to set up walls of intellectual property, which some claim is going to be used against it. So this is one of those interesting chess moves where you're not exactly sure what the next move is going to be coming from the player. It's interesting, but it's something we have to be aware of. We know for certain that if you had a chance to read the Microsoft memorandum that ended up being published shortly after this announcement was made, that Steve Ballmer thinks it's a wonderful thing. And frankly, he would, because this clears up some major problems with them, including the ability to license their Java or pseudo-Java engine, depending on how you look at it. So they're very happy with this deal. And, of course, most of us inside the open source community get a little bit suspicious whenever Microsoft gets too happy. So that's one of the things that we have to be on the lookout for here. Anyone else have anything on that one?
It's pretty huge news. I mean, the front page of the Wall Street Journal, you know, was yesterday, was about the new secret, behind secret settlement talks, new power of tech customers. See, these are the dots you have to connect. I mean, what makes the Yankee Group survey so specious in its own way is that not only this, you know, surveying from the top, they're asking the wrong question. You know, you want to do a forklift upgrade of your entire enterprise from whatever you've got to Linux, you know, and that's not the way it's been happening. It's not the way it's going to happen. What's happening, from what I've been hearing, and I'm sure the rest of us have been hearing, is that down in the rank and file inside in all sorts of organizations of all sizes are putting Linux to use in practical ways, and they like interoperability, and they've been leaning on Sun, and they've been leaning on Microsoft to start interoperating. And, you know, this story is being played 100 different ways, and there probably are 100 different ways to play it in the long run. But vendor sports is probably the least interesting, the most interesting and least relevant way to play it. It's really a story of an agreement reached between two companies that have different sets of problems have found some area of a common Venn diagram where they can make something happen. And we'll see what's going to be. I mean, to me, it's really interesting that Microsoft's paying them $2 billion. That's a significant chunk of change, and it certainly helps Sun out a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
But Sun is still laying off people. I got, you know, no sooner did this happen than I get a letter from one of my friends who's working at Sun saying, well, we'll see what happens after the next round of layoffs.
Yep. And in fact, I personally think, and I said so last Friday on the Linux Daily. I don't know if you guys have been listening to the Linux Daily yet. It is a real entity now, but that was one of the stories we were following last week. I think personally, it is unbelievably tasteless of Sun to, on the very same day, announce 3,300 layoffs. The same day as they're sliding $1.9 billion into their corporate coffers.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just terribly tasteless. It's such an irresponsible member of a business community to do something like that. And this isn't rocket science. I mean, do the math. I mean, you know, I know Sun has got a reputation for, you know, really paying people a ton of money, you know, paying people $75,000 or $80,000 for what they should be paying, $40,000. So fine, cut their salaries back to a more realistic layer, and all of a sudden those layoffs are going to become unnecessary in the scope of the fact that you got $2 billion in your coffers. They're bleeding at about $200 million a quarter. $2 billion, if they cut their... You know, cut the loss by a third by just reducing the payroll instead of eliminating the payroll. You know, that's going to be a blip in the amount of money that they're going to actually burn through. And it just seems to me, it's just totally distasteful from my standpoint that Sun would have the nerve to announce both of those things on the same day. Very, very irresponsible.
The question that immediately leaps to my mind is, did anyone note what the stock price did shortly thereafter? Unfortunately, I didn't see it.
Yeah, well, I watched it that day. It went up for both companies.
Yeah, and I have a feeling that's a major reason for that sense of timing.
Yeah, Doc, was this friend? You don't have to tell us who it is. Was this friend giving you any sense of what the company was going to actually do in terms of this reorganization?
No, not really. I mean, I just got an email from him saying, did you catch the news? And I said, yeah, and I, you know, whatever else you can tell me, I'd be interested in hearing. He said, well, you know, we'll see what happens after the next round of layoffs. You know, he survived quite a few of them. All of them, obviously, because he's still there. He's a loyal company guy. He's been working for him for about 20 years. But he's concerned, you know, like anybody would be. But he's also on, you know, he's a Java guy. He sounds upbeat about the prospects for... for what he does. I don't know. I mean, to me, it's very much a wait and see thing. But in the meantime, what I want to dig into, if any listeners want to help me out with this, feel free to write to me about it. I want to find out what exactly the customers were telling those guys. You know, I'm assuming it's interoperability. Okay, that's a great thing. You know, I mean, we all want interoperability. Does this signal a real sea change on the part of Microsoft? I mean, Microsoft went and released some open source on SourceForge today, or yesterday, whenever it was. It was pretty interesting that they would do that. Is this coincidental? Probably not. Not meaningfully coincidental. But, you know, at some point, I think Microsoft, if it's going to care about its customers, is going to have to say, well, we have to get along with whatever else is in there. And there's an awful lot of Linux in there, and there's an awful lot of stuff that's not theirs. And you know, and settling on the Java issue, which is really, you know, about deforking the Java community, is a significant thing. I think it's a little bit, you know, it's not. I'm not sure what particular relevance it has to, you know, to a pure Linux conversation, although all these things overlap to some degree.
I have a couple of bits for you. Number one, I did get contacted by a Sun employee who listened to what I had said last week on the Linux Daily, and this employee, for better or for worse, told me that a lot of the quote unquote layoffs that Sun does are suspect when you hear about them from the get go. That they're done as a method of calming the stock market more than actually executed within the company. They'll announce a layoff, and really what they're going to do is accelerate some retirements.
Mm-hmm.
They really don't lay off that many people, if any, and or they're, you know, the layoffs are constituted by a business that they had been negotiating to spin out or something like that. So this guy who was writing me said, don't judge it too quickly because it might not be as bad as we think it is. And so I want to cut him a little bit of slack on that. But cutting him slack on one side, I do think it is incredibly suspect that this settlement was reached at this time when Microsoft was, the books were being reopened by the SEC on Microsoft in Microsoft v. DOJ. Microsoft had been whacked by the EU, and Microsoft, an investigation of Microsoft had begun by the Japanese equivalent of the SEC, whatever they call that. It's interesting that this all timed together, because now Sun's complaints against Microsoft are no longer a part of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They're now off the table. So even though behind closed doors, Ballmer had to, look McNeely in the eye and say, well, yeah, we were guilty. Sorry, here's your $1.9 billion. He doesn't have to go and say that in front of a judge.
I think that has something to do with it, but my own feeling about it is, and this comes from talking to other people like Steve Gilmore, who's one of the people we have on the list of links here, writing any week. He did an interview with Jonathan Schwartz, who was elevated in the midst of this, by the way, which is a significant thing as well. What Schwartz said about the role of identity, for example. I mean, Sun has been a leader in the development of the Liberty Alliance, which is one particular approach to federating identity, which is basically a way for identities to be shared and with the permission of the people whose identities they are. You know, at a simple level, when you log into United site and you want to rent a car, that you don't have to re-enter a whole bunch of information because your cookie's following you along or whatever the thing is. There's a whole bunch of standards around that the Liberty Alliance is trying to foster. Now, of course, every alliance fosters an equal and opposite alliance. There's another one called the WS Federation, which Microsoft and IBM put together. And as Steve put it to me on the phone today, federation sounds pretty creepy, but he says if you look at it simply in terms of interoperability, there's a lot of places you can go with this. I mean, if you look at you know, your identity is something that travels with you from your cell phone to your PDA to this laptop to that laptop, and you authenticate your way into any one of them, and you get downloaded to you whatever widgets you need in order to do whatever business you need to do. Java certainly supports this, and they're both Microsoft and Sun have been frothing at the mouth about business opportunities around this for some time. Both of them are interested in the mobile phone space. Microsoft has taken a back seat there. Java's actually got a presence in the mobile phone space. So does Linux, for that matter. So there's just a lot of, if you're willing to interoperate, a lot of business opens up. And, I'm inclined to see it more in those terms in the long run. I think we've got a company that's trying not to go out of business, actually, in the case of Sun, because they're certainly fading, and yet they have an asset with Java that's in an awful lot of machines and they can do a lot with, I'm not saying these guys can actually cooperate. I just do think that there's more than maybe what meets the eye is, some of the bullshit that they're telling us, and they're going to have to make it real. It's bullshit right now. But
now, I find myself in a terrible dilemma right at the moment.
Yeah.
Because I honestly, I'm having a difficult time not being suspect of the timing of all this. And I'm, as I said before, I'm terribly bothered by the real cold and cavalier attitude on the left. And, a business has got to do what a business has got to do. I'm a free enterprise guy. I understand all that stuff. Believe me. But I'm still bothered by it. And I've got a moral dilemma that I'm going to be facing on Thursday, because Sun contacted us today about renewing their sponsorship with the Linux Show. I don't know if I want him to be sponsored.
I think we want him. An important thing to understand is that it's not one company. It's a bunch.
It's a whole bunch of little.
It's a whole bunch of things. The same with IBM, for that matter. The same is true with HP, and probably the there's some companies that you could say they're one company, like maybe Dell. I think Dell is kind of like one unified thing.
Yeah, it's
but
entirely stupid. It really is.
It's a machine, and the machine does what the machine does. But most companies have much more complicated situations than that. If you look at what's happening in the weblog world right now with Microsoft, there are a lot of employees that are speaking very freely, right? And they're being felt. Microsoft cannot turn those guys off. They can't turn them off.
They can fire them.
Huh?
They can fire them.
Yeah, but they, it's not happening. There's a limit to how much you can be belligerent and hostile and still succeed in the marketplace. And I think in Microsoft's case, I think that's something that they just have to do. And I'm sure that they looked at downstream on the Java situation and saw that there really wasn't an upside to whatever to trying to fight that thing, and there's just a lot of possibilities here. If the partnering involves Microsoft not trying to screw up Java and Sun not constantly insulting Windows, where Sun is helping all kinds of Java stuff run on JVMs no matter what they happen to be on, and Microsoft doing its best to make sure that stuff actually runs. There's a lot of business that can happen on top of that. Not much of it is very interesting from a Linux perspective, I don't think, and in a pure sense, but I think that there is. If there is a screw you in here to anybody, it is definitely from both Microsoft and Sun to IBM. But even there, if you look at the way the markets have been growing. I mean, Microsoft's been growing right alongside Linux inside companies. That's just a fact. I mean, it's just happening. And, you know, that's why it's such the Yankees group's questions are is so false. It's not, you know, and logic is happening all over the place. And, you know, I mean, we don't necessarily like it from a Linux perspective, but it's not like Linux is losing either. You know, Linux is winning and Microsoft's not losing.
And who knows, OpenOffice may end up saving Microsoft as a client-side operating system. You never know.
Absolutely. And it could be
an irony.
One of the things is somebody pointed out to me somewhere is that in Malaysia or someplace, the Microsoft sort of capitulated, or is it Singapore on per-client licensing, and this is supposed to be some kind of big deal. Asia is just an enormous marketplace, and is only going to get bigger. And Europe is huge, and Microsoft doesn't have a really good reputation there. And you know, at some point, if their pricing model, which is basically renting software, that's what it's been since the summer of 2000, when they raised the licensing costs. You don't really own your Microsoft software. It'll tell you that if you try to run two of my one subnet. You know, no, you can't do that. You know, it's in charge. You know, you're renting this stuff. You have very limited rights for the use of your own software when you're buying Microsoft software. Well, what if you're just renting and it's just a bunch of widgets that come down and operate, and you own your data? That's fine. Okay. But your software is something you rent. That actually is not something that's the business that Red Hat's in. That's the business that Oracle's in. That's the business if we take even the model that Linux is business is service, you know, you're not selling the software, but you're selling services that run on the software. Well, IBM's got a $42 billion business that's based on that notion, that what you need is service. And they'll, you know, as in the words of Scott McNeely, they'll darken the skies with consultants for you. All right? That's how IBM works. That's the only way IBM works, but it's a way that IBM works.
Software has always needed maintenance, and that's where the money is.
Yeah, there's money in that.
Microsoft sells the maintenance, but they sell it as a renting of the software.
Well,
they're doing what Linux is doing. They just talk differently.
In the long run, the companies. I'm sort of thinking out loud here, but to me, the takeaway from this is that, at least temporarily, is that. We're just watching all the vendors moving toward a service model, and where you're selling a pile of services in the form of code and agreements to back it up, and to deliver it in a variety of ways, and maybe it's not going to matter in the long run whether your platform is Windows or a JVM or Linux or OS X or whatever. That is becoming commoditized. And Linux has done that. Linux has commoditized the OS. And this is a commoditized OS story at some level. So what do they sell above the commodities? Well, you buy a stack. You know, and there are development communities around that stack. And, you know, maybe you buy a different stack. And maybe you move from stack to stack. I don't know. But there's the movement of the industry toward a service model for making money, and that's what this is about.
We're going from the cathedral to the bazaar, and that's what we need to do.
Yeah, well, it is a bazaar, but it's still, you know, people are still, you know, the Java development community is a little church, right? You know, and
yeah.
The free software guys are a little church, and the Mono / .NET people are a church of a sort. You know, there's a very funny piece that was done by a guy. I pointed to him in my blog. He wrote to me this morning. He said his takeaway from it was that what Microsoft sells is technology with a capital T. You know, and what the rest of the world wants to do is hacking, and what you do when you get technology is, you know, you're in Visual Studio or you're in some other environment like that where you're in you're sort of inside this bubble, and that's technology with a capital T. And it's an experience, right? It's not, and outside of it is, you know, you're working, you get your hands dirty, and you're in the command line, and you're hacking code, right? And it's a different thing. And I think he's actually onto something there. I think in the long run, though, it's not going to, what agreements like this mean is that those distinctions are less important to these companies over time. I think they're very important to developers, but to the guys actually working on the code, but they're less important to these companies. But I don't know. I'm just blathering away.
It's good blather, though. Very interesting take on the big picture of the situation. We are running a little behind, though. So are there other stories we need to get in there? Russ, was that was the end of your list, Matt?
Yeah, Doc touched on the last one, which was the Microsoft open source offering,
yep.
which we had discussed before, that if it did come, it was unlikely to be truly open source, and it was unlikely to be substantial, and it turns out apparently it is open source, but it's still not particularly substantial.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, Arnie, have you got anything for us this evening? Keep on.
Yeah, my first
we're tight on time.
Yeah, my first one was about the Microsoft code release, and I agree with Russ and Doc's evaluation. Let's move on to the next story. Was moving on to Linux may not save money yet. This is we've talked about that study we talked about that earlier. That was Russ's first one. And so I'll skip that one. There's a good article by Jim Raposa on eWeek called Fork in the Linux Road, or actually it's Fork in the Linux Road with a question mark in the end. And it's a really good advocacy article. It's on eWeek. The link is on the Linux World website. And he explains why Linux is not likely to fork. And that those people blathering about KDE GNOME as being a fork in Linux are just not right. That Linux is one kernel, and if you run GNOME, you can also run KDE and apps, and if you run KDE, you can also run GNOME apps. So it's a good article. That's Jim Raposa is, by the way, the labs director at Ziff Davis, which is a good place to have a Linux advocate. Really good little article on bargainpda.com, which shows the new Sharp Zorus, which is the SL6000L.
That's a good box.
Ooh, this is really, really cherry. It is a ruggedized PDA. Supposedly it will survive a drop of 1 meter onto a concrete.
Okay. How many feet is a meter, Arnie?
A little over 3 feet.
So don't get too excited. It's not that high.
Well, excuse me. I've dropped my Zorus from waist level, which is probably 3+ feet, onto a floor. I about screamed when it happened, and it survived just fine. The Zorus machine is a very, very well machine, and if they're advertising this, I have no doubt that this is made right. Okay, so I think this is a pretty good feature. It has 64 megs of RAM, 64 megs of flash RAM. It does run Linux, of course. It's basically the same form factor as the original SL5000 or SL5500. The little thumb keypad opens up the same way. You slide open the thing. It's got a 640 by 480 screen. No.
Four-inch display.
Oh, excuse me, 4-inch display. 480 by 640. 480 by 640 display, which you can flip sideways with the press of a key. I guess it's really, really nice. It's got a bigger battery, and I guess it's kind of a little bit bigger and thicker than the original Zorus.
It has to be because of a couple of features First of all, it's got a Intel CPU in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, X-Scale.
Yeah, it needs a little.
Which is basically an ARM design.
Yeah, it's still an ARM strong processor, but it's a little bit more powerful and it needs a little bit bigger heat sink apparently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And batteries are designed to be, even though they are bigger, so they'll have a longer shelf life, they're also designed to be somehow quickly hot swappable. So if you've got a spare battery, you can pop one out and put a new one in and just keep on going, which is a really cool feature as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, that is great. Yeah.
When you do that with the original, with this, my 5500, you have to power the machine down because when you flick the little switch to pop the battery out, it will cold start the computer when you start it again.
Yep.
This is a really nice machine. It's priced kind of hefty $700 US, but it is available now.
Yeah, well, the coolest thing about it, as far as I'm concerned, is that this is a pretty significant leap forward for the Sharp Zaris family of products. And it does have a steep price, but what this is going to do through those remaining 55 and 5600s, the price on those is going to drop quick.
Yeah. Did I mention it has 802.11b built in?
Built in. And Bluetooth. Built
no
in.
Bluetooth.
Yes, it does.
Or Bluetooth.
What?
No Bluetooth.
Yes, it does.
Let's see now what the article
is. Go to the Sharp website. They have two versions.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's right. They do have a Bluetooth version or it's an or you choose. But I think all the ones that are being sold that I've seen are from vendors the 802.11b version.
Yeah, very cool little box.
Yeah, I think this is very, very nice, and there's going to be a lot of catching up. It also has a speaker and a microphone. Which is good.
Yeah, that's the thing that surprised me, is I really thought that this generation of Zaris would have a built-in phone. That's the one thing that I'm surprised it doesn't have.
I don't look at this as a brand new model as much as an evolutionary step for the Zaris, because basically it's basically the same machine running the same Qtopia apps, and so I don't look at it as they're building something brand new here. They're obviously ruggedized the existing design and expanded it a little bit and put the better display on and added some more features and more memory and added the Wi-Fi. But this is basically the same Zaris. Okay, that's the 5600. And so, I would bet that Sharp has got some things in the works that they'll pop our eyes out. This incremental step is an indication. This is a very nice machine, by the way.
Well, any more stories you want to sneak in before?
Yeah, real quick. IBM is offering a supercomputer solutions department, and they had a press release on that today, and they're going to be pushing their eServer Blade Center in eServer X Series and eServer 325 with they're really pushing the supercomputer stuff, and that probably will mean lots of Linux sites. And the last thing is Groklaw has published an article, Open Source Software, What Is It and How Does It Work, by Dr. Ben Kramer. And basically this is an explanation of open source for the newbie from a legal standpoint, especially with concerning the licensing and stuff and how it works. And it's a pretty good article. There's one more article, and that is on Wired, and I don't have a link for that, but if you go to Wired, you can get it. And this is mentioned in a /dot thread today, and that is concerning Moore's Second Law, a fairly good read about, and I kind of agree with this guy, that if we don't get battery life up, we're doomed. Like, my Zaris here is really a wonderful machine, but if I'm using the Wi-Fi, it sucks the life out of the battery in about a little over an hour,
and I don't dare use the backlight and the Wi-Fi at the same time, and, you know, that's just too bad. And
we got to start broadcasting power. Tesla was right.
Yeah, whatever, something like that. I don't know, or just get a better battery technology because it just it's too expensive and too you know, the times are too short.
Okay, well, we're going to be taking a short break, but before I do, I want to point out a couple of quickie things. First of all, on our link list of articles, Doc didn't mention it when he was going on his long talk about IBM and Sun and et al. But there's a link of an article that Doc wrote on April 1st on our list, one of his Suitwatch articles. Make sure you check it out. It's actually one of the funnier things that was written on the April 1st puking of attempts at humor. So check it out. Link is there. Also, for those of you who are regular listeners, the Linux Daily is out there. If you have not listened to any of the shows on the Linux Daily, we do have a couple of them up. Make sure you check out the Linux Daily. We're still working out some of the bugs, but we're getting there. We've got a pretty slick, semi-automated way to create this show. I do want to leave out that invitation that if there's people out there who have something to say to the Linux community, that's really what the Linux Daily is for. It's not for me to talk every day, but it's for the Linux community to talk every day. So if you do have something that you want to bring to the Linux community, drop us an email at staff@geekcast.com, and we'll start a dialogue to get you set up with a little airtime. So, Kevin, why don't you take us for a break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes with segment number two. We'll be talking to Jim Pickerel from Brandex Internet in California about a call to action, some of which you've probably heard from us before. So hang in there, everybody. It's about 3 or 4 minutes away. We'll come back with segment number two of The Linux Show for April the 5th, 2004. And this is segment number two of the Linux Show for April the 5th, 2004. I'd like to thank our sponsors for making it possible for us to bring you the Linux Show. You go to our website, www.thelinuxshow.com, and chances are you'll see banners and ads for them splashed all over the website. But in particular, I would like to at least thank this month the people at the Golden Group, those people who bring us ISPCon, for being a sponsor of the Linux Show. There's also something else, and speaking of sponsorships, there is a new link that's going to be moved to a more high-profile place on the Linux Show, but right at the moment, the link for it is actually down in the copy for segment two. It's a PayPal donation button that will make a little bit more obvious and a little bit different from our normal PayPal button. And we'll get that up on the site later on tonight. But we want all you people who are the regular listeners to take note of that. We're going to be announcing in a press release later on this evening, probably at Linux Today in the normal places you normally look. But we're going to try and raise a little cash over the course of the next few weeks to provide a little bit of, shall we say, pocket money, expense money, for some people who are in the trenches doing the job the best that they can, you know, on behalf of their own businesses, perhaps, or really on behalf of really everybody. A lot of individual effort is required to keep the things that we love alive. And for those of you who are regular listeners of the Linux Show, if you've been with us for, say, more than 2 or 3 years, you'll remember a couple of years ago we spent a lot of time and a lot of effort getting a political action committee organized called GeekPAC, and we did make a little splash for about 4 or 6 months, but then the organization sort of fizzled out. It's very difficult to get political action committees formed, and it's even harder to keep them running in the partisan world we live in today. It's really hard to do. And so we're going to have this fundraiser out there not to raise money for an organization, but to raise money for individuals that we think are making an effort. And one of those individuals is our guest tonight on the Linux Show, and that's Jim Pickrell, who is the CEO and president of BrandX Internet. This is a small internet company out in California, and Jim has fought for not only the life of his ISP, but really for the rights of all ISPs and the rights of users of the internet as well. Jim's been out there sort of alone fighting this battle, but has done something pretty remarkable in terms of he's won a major court case all by himself against a cable company. And this is no longer a court case. This is now a finding of fact. It is a ruling of a court case. And so this is a big deal. This has gotten some notice by the ISP community, of which Kevin and I are a part of when we take off our Linux guy hats and put on our ISP hats on. So Jim has done something remarkable and gotten noticed to the point where a lot of the people in the ISP trade associations, who, frankly, have been a little lacking in their efforts to defend ISPs, are taking notice of what Jim has done and have started to line up behind him. And I think that's great that for the first time, really, in years and years and years and years, the ISP trade associations are getting excited about something that an individual in the trenches has accomplished. And so I am really, really proud to have Jim Pickrell on the show tonight. And I'd like to, well, Jim, welcome to the Linux Show, first of all.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me.
And why don't you tell us the story behind how you got involved with the lawsuit against your cable company?
Well, I've always been kind of active in promoting sort of competitive internet services because, you know, as a small internet company, we are the competition. So when competition gets closed out, well, you know, that's very bad for our business. And the situation has become so serious that even as a small company, we just felt like we had to do something. And it's kind of a shame because a few years ago, independent ISPs were really the majority and the phone companies and the cable companies weren't really interested in the Internet. But when these legal battles and battles promoting different rulings and laws in front of Congress and so on, and court battles were being started, everybody was kind of waiting for someone else to do it. And this gets very frustrating. I was the president of the California ISP Association, and trying to get people involved in getting involved in some of these FCC issues and federal issues, and it's very hard because everybody's being pulled in 20 different directions, and they have small budgets, and those budgets are spoken for, and, you know, money that's used for a legal battle might come directly out of somebody's salary or something. So it's, you know, that's a tough decision to make. I think I'll, you know, give myself a $2,000 salary cut and use the money to finance a legal effort. But the flip side of it is that if people don't get together and do these things, then they get creamed. And the big cable companies and the telephone companies, their real area of expertise is the ability to lobby. Because if you want to be a telephone company, what do? Well, you run lines through public areas and you get your rates set and things like that. They're all done through lobbying, through coercing public officials and getting them to do what you want. That's what they're good at. And ISPs thought they didn't have to do that. And guess what? They're wrong. You do have to do that because the telephone companies and cable companies have drawn the battle into the arena where they have the advantage. And Internet services, independent Internet services, when they were the majority, had a good way to fight back just by numerically having a lot of users and having the potential to mobilize them, but they've kind of squandered that. And now independent ISPs are very much on the defensive. Within all of this, we were looking to say, well, what can we do? There's a lot of things that we'd love to do. We'd love to file antitrust suits. We'd love to be active in front of public utilities commissions. We'd love to, you know, lobby against the Tozan Dingell bill. We'd love to, you know, there's a lot of different things you could do, and there's a lot of different legal approaches that you could take. And we were looking and trying to figure out where would our money be best spent, because our money is very, very limited. And in conversations with Harvey Ryder, who's the attorney who's done most of the work on this and who deserves huge, huge, huge credit, We all became collectively convinced, which is collectively as me and Harvey primarily, although there were some other people who came to the same conclusion, Dave Baker from Earthlink, the people from the California Public Utilities Commission, they came to the same conclusion that the one of the battles that was most important to fight was about application of the Telecommunications Act to broadband internet services. And here's basically what the battle is. The Telecommunications Act generally is to ensure competition. Now, if you were to talk to Michael Powell from the FCC, he would tell you something very different. But if you look at the Telecommunications Act, which incidentally is what gives the FCC its authority, it's supposed to promote competition, and the idea is that competition will be good for consumers. And Michael Powell and his friends wanted to find a way to exempt the cable companies and the telephone companies so that they could have unfettered monopolies in their broadband services. And they were running into conflict with the Telecommunications Act that says that these things should be competitive. And the way out of it was to simply say, well, we'll declare that these broadband services are not telecommunications services, and therefore the law doesn't apply. The Telecommunications Act wouldn't apply to non-telecommunication services, or the competitive requirements wouldn't apply. And within this, there were two debates. one relating to cable modems and one relating to DSL. Now, our business is primarily DSL. We don't have any cable modem business, only in our dreams. We wish we had a cable modem business, but we don't. But nevertheless, we got involved in challenging the cable modem decision by Michael Powell because that track was a year ahead of the DSL track, and by the time the DSL track came up for discussion, the cable modem track would already be decided, and at that point it would be too late. So it looked to us like this was the fight to get involved in, and so we did.
So you did.
So we did, and what we did, and stop me here if I get wandering too far off on a tangent in explaining the legal details, but I'll tell you all about it. Basically, what you do if the FCC makes an announcement that you don't like, you can appeal it. And the there were five groups actually that challenged this, I believe five that challenged this ruling, and one of them was Earthlink. And I think we are in general agreement with Earthlink on the issue. There are some small differences. Then there was the states of California and Vermont and some city and state organizations that also disagreed with this ruling, although they might not have had exactly the same reasons, because there's also some jurisdictional issues, because if it is or isn't a telecommunications service, should state or federal authorities regulate it? So they were interested in contesting these issues too. And then, interestingly enough, also Verizon, in a weird way, came in on our side with the Me Too appeal. And their appeal was that they thought that if cable modems should be exempted, then DSL should be exempted too. And so on that basis, technically they're on our side, although they are not on our side because they're a monopoly. But technically they're on our side because they thought that the FCC should have at that time announced that DSL was also not a telecommunications service. Now, they got that through the back door anyway, so they've kind of lost enthusiasm, but, you know, in some sense they were appealing. So the next decision to be made was which court would have jurisdiction to hear this appeal. And Harvey Ryder and I felt that the Ninth Circuit Court, which is California, which is where I am, would be the right place. The Ninth Circuit is California and Washington and Alaska, and I maybe Nevada's in it, in Oregon, I'm not sure. But in any case, it's the West Coast Federal Court. And these other folks from Earthlink and so on had filed in Washington, D.C. And the reason that we wanted to file here, besides the fact that we are here, is because there was an earlier case in Oregon where this issue had already been decided, that cable modems, it's called the Portland case, the city of Portland versus AT&T, and it had already been decided that cable modems were a telecommunications service, and because the courts are sort of required to follow their own precedents, it seemed like kind of a slam dunk. So there was a heated debate about this, and we won this debate, and the appeal was in the Ninth Circuit, and so these other people came in and still participated, but they participated in the Ninth Circuit. So that's how the appeal got filed, and the issue ended up in the actual court case. The actual legal discussion was pretty simple, because the people from the FCC and the cable associations basically said, gosh, it would be really nice if we could just have our monopolies and we don't want to have all this competition that causes uncertainty, and uncertainty makes development impossible, and if we don't have our monopolies, the Internet will never get rolled out, which is, you know, pretty reminiscent of the same discussion that John Rockefeller was making in defending his monopoly, where he was arguing that if Standard Oil didn't have a monopoly on oil drilling, then no oil would get drilled. Well, you know, that just didn't turn out to be the case, and it isn't the case here either. And so anyway, on our side, we're just arguing, well, this has already been decided in the Portland case, so, you know, the precedent is there, so it pretty much needs to be followed. And then I went and watched the hearing, and it was real interesting. And what had basically happened, the FCC was aware of this Portland case, and the Portland case did apply to the FCC because it's a federal case. And so the judges were saying to the guy from the FCC, so you knew this decision had been made, and then you made this ruling that was in direct contradiction to it. So is it your opinion that the FCC doesn't have to follow the rulings of the court? And the guy from the FCC said, well, this is what you call Chevron deference, that the courts should respect the general authority of these administrative bodies like the FCC. And basically his position was that the FCC could completely ignore the court system, and the court apparently didn't see it that way and didn't agree with them, and they lost.
Especially the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit does have a well-established reputation for being a little bit radical and being willing to challenge other bodies of government.
I'm not sure if being pro-competition is all that radical. I don't know. Where I went to elementary school, we were told that was the American way.
Absolutely. I agree with you. But what I say in terms of radical, I should say going opposed to what's behind the Beltway in D.C.
Yeah. Well, it's a strange and mysterious world out there. But that's kind of what the people from the people from the FCC and the cable companies thought they ought to be able to find somebody who saw things their way and liked the big companies. And so what they did, the appeal to that is what's called, and they asked for an en-banc hearing. And what that is where when the Ninth Circuit Court hears a case, there are something like 32 judges in the Ninth Circuit Court, and there are courtrooms all over the place. There's a courtroom in Seattle. There's one. There's, you know, downtown. There's downtown LA. There's one in Pasadena. I think they're separate. There are other ones, and there are judges, a bunch of judges, and they wanted to have all 32 judges sit in and rehear this case. And they went around. They took it to these different judges, and the vote was 32-0, thumbs down. And that's interesting to me because you would have thought they would have had somebody who was in love with one of these cable companies, somebody who thought that big monopolies were the ticket to a happy internet, but they weren't able to find one, and that's interesting to me. The battle's not over yet, but round one we won 3-0, round two we won 32-0. The other side hasn't scored any points yet, so there will be another round, and Michael Powell has sworn that he will take this to the Supreme Court, and I guess he has 60 days or something to submit a filing there, and so we'll see what happens there, whether they choose to hear it or not. I think they probably will. I hope they won't, because it's expensive, and so far all of the money for this has just come out of my pocket personally, which is not a very deep pocket, so that's a problem. And the idea of another pile of bills for the Supreme Court is not something I would look forward to, but at the same time, it's that or close, because the downside of losing something like this, if you lose the cable thing, you've lost the DSL thing, and the Telecommunications Act is completely and totally removed from all broadband services, and the FCC has pretty much announced that they want to promote monopolies as the way to promote services, and we're hosed, we're out of business.
Yep.
And that's bad, so we don't want that, so we're going to go the distance.
Yeah, and really it's that last issue why I'm really so enthusiastic behind getting behind you and lining up with you, because there was a noticeable wholesale change in the attitude of our federal bureaucracy that started at about 1989-1990 and really has continued since, and that was a wholesale shift in the type of statute that was being passed, and that those kind of statutes and regulations were in support of big, and whatever big was better. And so you've really seen our government, and I'm not pointing a finger at any party, they're both doing this, they're getting behind whatever's big, big business, big labor, big. And big has never been an innovator. Big has never been a real solution to necessarily getting new things accomplished. And, I mean, after all, who the hell do they think built the Internet? It certainly wasn't phone companies.
Well, it's kind of funny. I remember there was a little factoid that kind of made me laugh a few years ago. This was before AT&T had entered the cell phone business and then before they got back out of the cell phone business, which I guess they're out of it now. But at the time when they had no cell phone business and there was just a at least here in Southern California, there was a two-party monopoly on cell phone service, a big survey was done on what company had the best cell phone service, and the hands-down winner was AT&T. And I thought that was just hilarious because they weren't in that business, but just people assumed because they're like this great big company, they must have a great service. And I do not understand this thinking, but even people who believe that way, I think still benefit from competition because it keeps the pressure up and it keeps them honest. But you look at I mean, there are some countries who tried the big monopoly as a recipe for success. Russia would be a good example. Czechoslovakia. I mean, you look at the old telecom business telecom is the name of the Czech telephone company, and you know, people had not unheard of to have a 10-year wait for installation of a telephone line. You know, if you don't have any competition, you can do stuff like that. And why someone would choose that kind of system on purpose is just beyond me.
Yeah, I'm at a loss as to explain the attitude of Michael Powell, and I'd like to see the business books that educated him on building a nationwide telecommunications environment. Boy, I think the guy is just clueless.
It's funny because you know I've been to his office and I've met him, but I haven't really talked to him. But I've talked to some of his staff, and you know what? They're nice guys. They're actually sincere. They're just very, very wrong. And it's kind of mind blowing. If you get on the FCC website, you can see statements from the different. You know, there are different commissioners. There are, I think, five commissioners, and three of them are Republican, two of them are Democrats. Powell is a Republican, but I don't see this as a party issue. I had always thought that Republicans were the party that would support small businesses. It doesn't seem to be the case, but it's not inconsistent with being a Republican that they could be small business. I could imagine a Republican who would be friendly to competition. I think it's possible. I don't see this as a party issue, but no, it is a Michael Powell issue.
It's a behind-the-beltway issue. Everybody in D.C. is so inundated with the lobbying done by big, once again, big business, big agriculture, big labor. They're so inundated with that lobbying from big that they can't see beyond big, and they only think big is good.
It's interesting looking on the FCC website at what Michael Powell has said about this latest court decision, which was just a couple of days ago, where we had the 32-0 victory over the FCC. And he had announced previously that if they lost that they would appeal. And in this one he said that he thought that opening things up to competition would cause uncertainty, and that this would prevent people from getting the Internet, would prevent broadband rollout. And I just thought that was really interesting, that the issue, that the thing that Michael Powell stands for, and he seems to really be sincere about this, is that what business needs is certainty, not competition. I mean, Never mind that the Telecommunications Act is sort of his marching orders. The Telecommunications Act is the Bible for the FCC. The Telecommunications Act lays out the marching orders for the FCC. And the Telecommunications Act promotes competition. It has no other purpose.
Yep.
And yet, somehow or other, Michael Powell has turned this on its head. His mission is to promote certainty for these big monopolies, and I just don't see that being as consistent.
Yep.
Question from the IRC channel from Dave Mooring, New Zealand. Have you talked to FCC Commissioner Michael Copps?
Have I?
Mm-hmm.
I have talked to people in his office. I've talked to I've gone down to the FCC several times, and I've talked to his assistant, who's a lawyer, and some of the other people in his office, and I thought they were very helpful. And
this also from Dave. FCC Commissioner Michael Copps made the following statement today on the decision of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to uphold its cable modem ruling. This is, quote, "This is a good day for consumers and internet entrepreneurs. I look forward to the start of a fresh dialogue on broadband service at the FCC."
Right on. Yeah, he's helpful. He's made a lot of positive statements and a lot of positive votes. The votes on these competition things generally go 3-2, with the swing vote sometimes being Kevin Martin, who's one of the other commissioners. And I think we're happy to have Copps there. I don't agree with him on absolutely everything. He did vote, I believe, to eliminate line sharing. I disagree with that. I just don't know why they thought that was a good plan. It contradicts everything else he stands for. He is in favor of competition. He is in favor of small business. And for some reason, he got talked into voting against line sharing. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, just to give the listeners a little bit of an idea of some of the shenanigans that have gone on in the FCC, and I'm speaking from my experience, my perspective, because, in my ISP role, I've done a modest amount of lobbying at the FCC, and I've even showed up at a number of their hearings, especially when they happen to have them in the Chicago area. And a lot of these hearings, Michael Powell, if the discussion is going to be about a subject he is opposed to, he won't even show up to the hearing. And that has been true of all four FCC hearings I have gone to, where the focus has been about listening to opposing views. He has not showed up.
Well, I don't think he's interested in that part of it, is he?
Yeah.
I got to hand it to, some of the people like one of the other commissioners is Abernathy or Kevin Martin, that I was very happy that even though I didn't necessarily agree with their point of views, that they were willing to take the time to discuss and talk about them, and they were willing to listen to views which they knew they probably wouldn't agree with, but at least they wanted to understand the logic behind it. And even some of the people in Michael Powell's office were very kind to take time and to discuss their opinions. And I wish that Michael Powell had that ability to listen to opposing opinions too. I think, I'm interested to hear opinions that I disagree with, because even if it doesn't convince me, it may convince me even more that I'm right and they're wrong. But you test your own views. You understand your opponent. It allows you to create better arguments and to better understand why each side is in the position that they have. I don't think Michael Powell is interested. Michael Powell, from day one, knew what his position was and knew which direction he wanted to go in. And this entire thing that they do in the FCC of having proceedings and things where they have a track and they'll have hearings and all of that, it's a sham. They're not interested in general they're not really interested in what we have to say. And I think as ISPs, we need to go down there and participate in that process. But the fact is, as long as Michael Powell has this position that bigger is better and that monopolies are the only way to roll out the internet, then, you know, we're not going to get a fair hearing, and that's why we have resorted to the court system. Basically, that was a big part of my decision to get involved in this court case, was because of going down to the FCC and talking to people directly. You know, I've talked to a lot of people there, and it became clear to me that no action was going to come out of the FCC, that no amount of good intentions from cops or anybody else, or, you know, Robert Cannon, who's just like great. There's a lot of really good people down there, but it just wasn't going to happen because Michael Powell was in charge, and Michael Powell had already made his decision. And as long as he's there, I don't think it'll change. If it does, if he changes his mind, I'd welcome that. But I don't think that'll happen, and I don't think refusing to show up for hearings where other people would be speaking gives us any feeling that he would be willing to reconsider his opinions.
Yep. Yeah. Now, let's take this in a slightly different direction, if we could. Let's presume that over the course of the next several months that this is heard by the Supreme Court and you win, and some of the lobbying that I'm hearing is being planned to start up starting next week. For those of you who are listeners, there is a group of ISP trade associations that are going to be meeting 1 week from tomorrow in Washington, D.C. to sort of settle their differences. ISP trade associations are like anything else. They're competitive with each other, and they've never been able or rarely been able to unite on anything. And Jim's success has given them a ray of hope, a basis on what, on something to unite behind. And it appears that the surviving major trade associations are going to pull some resources together and begin some lobbying starting next week.
I'm very excited about this. This is a good sign and something that should have happened a long time ago.
In 1996, it should have happened.
Yeah. It's interesting how the different ISP associations have come apart. California, actually, although there's been times when I've disagreed with them, but California has a good ISP association as those things go. And there's also a good one in Texas, and there's a good one based in Florida that's kind of branched out from there. Interestingly enough, there, as far as I know, there doesn't seem to be a real active ISP community in Chicago. I don't know why.
The IISP shut down years ago.
Yeah. They've been creamed by SBC, I guess. There doesn't seem to be anything in New England. And there's a lot of people in, I mean, there's more people in New England than there is in California, so why do we have the more active internet?
Yeah, actually, ironically, it's the North Carolina ISP Association that seems to be handling the people from New England, or just because it's the only thing, the only game in town that's reasonably close by.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I think internet services need a national voice. I think what I've found in the past is that we get along very well with other people who are in the same industry. You know, we tend to have a certain common interests, like pizza and beer and computers and women and stuff like that, and all get along real well on a social level. And we'll often do cooperative business projects with other small ISPs because we kind of all look at it as it's kind of us against the world, you know. When we get customers, we're not taking them from each other. We're taking them from Verizon or from SVC or from Adelphia or whoever. We're small enough fish that we don't even see each other that much. So it's easy for us to work together on things. But when it comes to these kind of lawsuits, particularly one like this Ninth Circuit thing, which is purely it's an underlying issue, which is the legal underpinnings of our entire right to be in business, because that's what this is really about. It's about the small ISP's right to buy transit over these lines, whether they be DSL lines or cable lines. You know, we should be able to buy transit, pay for it fairly, but because they're going through public right-of-way, they fall under the Telecommunications Act, and they should be required to sell these lines to anybody who wants it at the same price. It should
at
be a level
price.
I have a local ISP that I buy from in Southern California.
Uh-huh.
But I get my wire from, I pay two separate charges, I get two separate bills. I pay my wire charge to Verizon, who's a local provider here.
Mm-hmm.
And I pay my ISP for the bandwidth.
That's right. That's how all of our customers are. Just out of curiosity, who are you with?
Kiwi.
I don't
Ontario.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
They're like you. They're small.
Mm-hmm.
And like friendly.
I've never heard anything bad about them. That's the problem.
I'll tell you right now, they're really good ISP. Really
well, I'm glad to hear that.
And they're small, like Brand X.
The problem that we have with those DSL customers that are like that is that Verizon is currently charging more for the line for that kind of service than they would charge for the entire retail service, including email and all that other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes an untenable business situation. And
I know that.
You can try to have really, really great services and friendly technical support and, you know, stuff like that. But at the end of the day, we should be able to, you know, a customer should not be penalized for not choosing the monopoly company as their ISP.
And I am. I'm penalized.
You're paying a premium to support competition, and hopefully you're getting really good services.
I get nominally good service.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't have any outages at all.
Uh huh. Well, that's cool. There was an interesting study that I'd heard about that was done by Bell Canada on DSL. Well, this is a live issue in Canada too, and the CRTC, which is the regulatory commission up there in Ottawa or Toronto or wherever, they're having, you know, discussions over similar issues. And Bell Canada had researched what does it cost to provide DSL service, and the answer they came up with was $10 Canadian a month, and that's which is like $7 American. So, I mean, what kind of price are you seeing on your bill for the line only? Is it like
the line is 40 some bucks a month?
Yeah. So why are they taking something that costs
50? It's like 50. Let's say cost 50 a month.
Why are they taking something that costs 7? This is the line portion or both?
The line portion.
Yeah. Why are they? Oh, then you have one of the faster speeds. You don't.
I have a gold.
Okay.
I have the synchronous one, when it's 768 both ways.
Right. Well, that's yeah. So if that, and notice that the price doesn't depend on the speed. You know, Verizon could be giving everybody the gold, but they don't, because they want to play this price point game that their MBA people told them was a good idea, so that way they can extract maximum dollar from everybody. And it's not a competitive market. You know, in a competitive market, you can't price people like that. You can't try to, you know, put your supply and demand curve up there and try and capture the whole thing. In a competitive environment, the prices are driven down and the services are maximized.
Mm-hmm.
Because
my ISP says it this way. He says they're a customer of Verizon,
mm-hmm.
and Verizon is in competition with them.
Yes.
And not only that, not only is Verizon in competition with them, but Verizon is unfairly in competition because Verizon won't give them the same rate that they give their own customers.
Well, that's absolutely right, and that's the core of the issue.
And Bell South does the same thing. Pac Bell does the same thing.
Yeah, Pac Bell actually pioneered that.
Yeah, and also you can't be online 24/7 on Pac Bell. You have to log in and stuff like that.
How frightening this really is. A picture over the course of years of how badly this has evolved. In 1995 and the through 96, the ISP that Kevin and I were involved in at the time, we were beginning the process of rolling out our own DSL product. And in the experiments that we were doing back in the old WWA days, we were paying $11 a month to Illinois Bell Telephone, which became Ameritech, for the dark copper. $11 a month. So this, you know, goes exactly along with what Jim was saying about that their costs are about $7 a month, and they throw a little profit on top of it and charge, you know, $10-$11 a month. It just so happens that they were charging us about 25 cents more than they were charging the security companies for dark copper that was used for security systems. The difference was that the security people were actually getting twice as much copper on average as we were, and in terms of the length of runs and things like that, because, of course, an alarm system isn't as distance-sensitive as something like DSL is. So the phone companies were making money by reselling copper to ISPs at $11 a month, and they were happy to get it.
Well, you know, if you look at it from the other side, I mean, the discussion of the CRTC, I think, is real interesting, because there where they came up with this $10 price, and what's happening there is that, you know, an ISP groups are lobbying that this should be the basis for the pricing. And I think, I mean, I'm probably, you know, some Canadian person will probably call up and correct me on my numbers because I'm just making them up. But the this will give you the general flavor. Something like a telephone company might be entitled to make a 25% profit or something, which in the world of business is a pretty good profit.
That's good, very good.
But if your cost is $7, then, you know, it should be $10 out the door. And so Bell Canada is right now just, you know, really trying to stall and prevent a decision being made that would roll back their prices. They're currently charging $24 for DSL, which is Canadian, which is, how much is that in God's money?
That's $1 American, I think.
24 Canadian, let's see, it's like 70 cents for a Canadian dollar or something like that. So say 3/4 of 24 would be like $17 or $18 would be their line price. See, a price like that is actually not that bad. And interestingly enough, in Canada, the companies are supposed to sell the DSL even if you don't have dial tone. In other words, you could say, I want my DSL going over Bell Canada, but I don't want your phone service. I'm going to use my cell phone. And that's okay, and they're required to support that. And financially, it works out. These are prices they chose. This is not, I mean, these other groups trying to roll it back to $10 from $17 to $10. And I have no idea, you know, when that will be decided. But here we have in this country, we have, you know, very similar people with similar equipment arguing that, you know, they need to charge you $50 for the same line. And then you look at what is the equipment, what is the investment that they're making. In order to support DSL, the phone line was, like, already paid for a long time ago, right? I mean,
that's 70 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, and they're allowed to pay that off and add their 25% profit or whatever on top of that. That's like 100% profit for them. And they already sold that to you. Now they're going to take the same telephone line and they're going to sell it to you all over again. And that's just pure gravy. That's just pure profit. There's very little expenses involved. The expenses involved are the modem, and you need a modem at either end. The modem at the telephone company end is called a DSLAM, and it's basically just a bunch of modems in a rack. And so the cost of a modem these days is $50 to $100 or something. Let's say they paid $100 for each end. So that's $200 worth of equipment. And let's say they match that with some other back-end equipment and fancy accounting and stuff. They cost another $100. So they're out, you know, $300 or something like that is their setup cost for you. And that pays for all their equipment. And what's their cost of capital? About 5%. So 5% of $300, that will tell you what their cost is of providing this service. 5% of $300 is $15. This is their annual cost. This is my estimate of their annual cost to provide DSL service. So when Michael Powell is saying that these people won't have an incentive to roll out the services if they don't have their monopolies, I think he is sadly mistaken. The incentive is money, and money has done pretty adequately all along.
Yeah, prior to the 1996 Act, when there was no barrier to purchasing dark copper, they were overjoyed to sell it. They were perfectly enthusiastic about it. But if they're handed a club, like the 1996 Telco Deregulation Act, where they can use it to beat ISPs over the head, what do you think they're going to do? Of course they're going to do it. And it was fairly obvious early on what was going to end up transpiring in all of it.
Well, what's happened is that they're making boatloads of money. These guys, it's funny because these big telephone companies, Verizon and SBC, are really the ones that I know about because they're the ones that are active in this area. They go and they're crying to the regulators and they're saying, like, we're on hard times. They have never, ever made so much money. They have never, ever had so much cash rolling in. And they go and they start laying people off. Verizon has been laying people off in California, and just crying, and they're making tons and tons of money to the point where, I mean, SBC is Singular, you know, pretty much owns Singular Wireless, and they just bought out AT&T. They got so much cash, they don't know what to do with it. And they're using the money that they've got out of DSL to buy themselves into to other businesses and get rid of competition there too.
Okay, let's again push this because we are running short on time. Let's again push this in a slightly different direction. Okay, you've won. Let's just say you will win your court case in the Supreme Court. The ISPs are going to successfully lobby. The next thing in the chain of events is that there is going to be both the FCC asking for tariff language, and there is going to be people in Congress asking for regulatory language. How do you envision, should this case stand up, how do you, as the person who has been fighting this battle, how do you envision the service that you want to see go over your local cable system?
What we'd really like to do is we'd like to provide services that are independent of the mechanism for crossing that last mile of territory out to the customer's home, whether it be wireless or cable or DSL or whatever. The service that we would like to provide would be relatively the same, and you know, we have consumer grades of service and we have business grades of service, whether you have a static address or dynamic address and things like that. These kind of choices are relatively independent of the type of wire that goes out to the consumer. Our big challenge is that you can win this thing, but it's kind of like, actually, we've always had these rights. You know, we're not actually getting anything new. What we're doing is we're just fighting to not get clobbered, you know, to prevent them from taking our rights away. Because we've always had, legally, the right to buy these things, to buy lines at fair prices, or that our customers should not be penalized for choosing us as their ISP. But the laws just haven't been enforced. And so we win the case, and then, you know, Michael Powell goes, well, you know, okay, you win, but I think we'll just, like, have a big policy discussion and 5 years of hearings, and then they do nothing. And I think that is the most likely outcome from the FCC side. So then the ball goes back into our court, and it's how do we take this court victory, which we already have. We've already won. We've already won, and we've won the first appeal, but our technical status is we win. And how do we turn that into actually providing services for people? And I guess the next step is we go to the different cable companies like Time Warner, and we ask to interconnect to them. We ask them to provide services to us, and then they tell us to go pound sand or perhaps take a long walk on a short Santa Monica pier And then we're back in court again. And I think that's the most likely scenario, that basically we would approach Time Warner, specifically Time Warner, I think, is the one, and Adelphia, and ask them if we could work out some agreement with them. And then if we can't, then we sue them. And we ask the court to force them to open things up. In reality, if I were a legislator, the solution that I would suggest is completely different. The way things should be is that if you're a line provider, then you shouldn't be a service provider, because there's an inherent conflict of interest by being both the controller of the monopoly lines and a competitor on the internet service front or the long distance front or whatever. They just shouldn't mix the two. And if telephone companies weren't in the DSL business, then they would promote choice, they would promote people who would promote their line services, and everybody'd be a lot better off. I mean, if people really wanted to have good services, then what they should do is they should force these big cable companies to sell off their internet divisions and have them be run truly competitively.
Interesting scenario.
It's just a dream. It won't happen, but that's the right way to do
it. Well, you know, don't say it won't happen. I think there is the likelihood that something is going to happen, because I see things like Wired Magazine and those in media that are on the periphery between the dominant culture and the technology culture are really starting to move these issues into the forefront. And I think it's only a matter of time before the public begins to realize that the system that has been in place since the 1996 Act has been totally deficient and has totally failed, and that we bring it back into the competitive sphere. Bottom line, entrepreneurism works. Entrepreneurism is what created the internet, and the sooner the public, you know, gets a grasp on the fact that the bigs out there have wrecked the internet or are in the process of wrecking the internet, I think the quicker we're going to see things like this come to fruit.
Well, you know, if we had a real competitive environment, what would happen would be things like, right now, internet services tend to be one-directional. Like, if you have a cable modem, you can download, but you can't upload, or you can upload, but very slowly. Those kinds of things would change, and the pricing would come down. I think that in a truly competitive market, the price for a broadband connection would be about $20, and it would work in both directions, and you could use it for things like video phone. And the decisions that they have made about promoting these monopolies have limited people's choices and have prevented things like video phone technology from really becoming a reality, where it very, I mean, the technology is there, right? I mean, you can, with Microsoft NetMeeting, you can do video phone, right? But most people's connections won't support it, or they'll support it very badly. And it could be really good, and there's people would get a lot of benefit and save a lot of money. And I think that most people, if you talk to them, they really do support competition. It's the regulators who live in this kind of regulatory paper bag where they're trying to keep the big, you know, from a regulator's point of view, a lot of times they're looking like, well, we have these different opposing lobbyists. How can we keep everybody happy? Well, the phone companies want this, the cable companies want that, you know. And like, the consumers don't have any lobbyists, so nobody cares, so they get ignored. But I think consumers actually do support competition. I mean, I don't see any big consumer group coming out and saying, we have too many choices, we want less choices, we want somebody else to choose for us. I don't see that. I think people do support choice.
Yep. Well, we are up to, boy, it is 10 minutes to 10. We've run way over our normal length, but it's been a really interesting show. Jim, I'm really glad that we could get you on, and I'm going to be looking forward to meeting you next week at ISPCon for...
Yeah, that'll be fun. That'll be fun.
For any of those of you in the Washington, D.C. marketplace, make sure you check out ISPCon, www.ispcon.com. The expo part of the event is free. Also, if you will email me at staff@geekcast.com if you are in the market, in the D.C. market. I'm hoping to get some time on Thursday. I'm probably not going to be spending much of my time at the expo on Thursday. I'm hoping to spend that day at the haunting the halls of Congress, knocking on doors. If you would like to join me in doing a little grassroots lobbying, contact me at staff@geekcast.com. I'd be glad to have the help knocking on those doors. Don't worry, we'll create documents and scripts for you so you won't have to go in blind. So,
I've done that before. That's actually kind of, it's real interesting. It's kind of fun in a perverse way to go through Congress and go into these office buildings and meet a lot of these people. That's and it's something they need to hear from people. You know, a lot of people don't realize that you can actually call up your congressperson in our area. It's Jane Harman, who's just great. You can call up people like that. You can go visit them. You can tell them what you think. You can call up and say, I live in your district, and I care about this issue. This affects my job. This is something that's near and dear to me, and I'd love to come down and talk to you about it and find out, you know, blah 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 blah. And then, you know, you can do that. They're there. They'll listen to you. And this is one thing that's good about the system. And the sad thing is that the only people that take advantage of it seem to be these big companies.
Yep, that's a fact. In terms of the Linux show next week, we're still unsure of exactly how the schedule is going to work out. We're planning on doing a full schedule of shows. There will be four Linux dailies, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday will be they will not be pre-recorded. There will be live shows from the floor of ISPCon. We're not broadcasting wall-to-wall like we do at most trade shows. It'll just be an hour or two of broadcasting at the most, just to give you an idea of what's going on with the ISP community. And we'll be talking to those Linux vendors that do show up as well. But for sure, do join us next Tuesday night on the Linux Show. Until then, on behalf of the whole panel here at the Linux Show, this has been the Linux Show for April the 5th, 2004. Thanks for stopping by. Thanks for joining us in the IRC. We'll see you next week. We're out of here.
Come and liberate me.